This audio file featuring Andy Crouch was recorded at the 2008 Graduate Faculty Ministry National Staff Meeting.
It's worth coming all this way just to see friends like Jeff and lots of others in the room. I wish I could remember what Bilbo said on his 111th birthday or whatever it was. I know half of you half as well as I'd like, and I like half of you less well than I should or something. That's sort of how I feel when I'm with this group. I know an awful lot of you, and we have reasons. We have a lot of information on each other, I think. What we'll do tonight is just get started. I love the idea that I get three shots at you guys, plus an extra bonus workshop if you come tonight or tomorrow, although there's some very stiff competition. So tonight we're just going to begin, and it will really just feel like a beginning. It will not feel like a lot of things are wrapped up. You'll probably leave 40 minutes from now with more questions than answers, and perhaps not even entirely certain where all of this is going. But fortunately, you have to stay, because it's like your job. So I'll get another shot tomorrow, and we'll see if by the time we leave on Thursday, some things have become a little clearer in terms of what our calling is, and perhaps more importantly, what the callings are of the students and faculty and staff that we get to work with in ministry, and that I get to live with in my house, even though I'm no longer in campus ministry. I left campus ministry, which was a hard enough job to explain, for an even more difficult job to explain, which Jeff tried to explain. I became a journalist, which is kind of a fall from grace, I think, from ministry. I don't know where it falls on Cam's list. I don't think it was very high. right, just above artists, yeah, thank you. But I've come to realize that what journalists do, essentially, is make complicated things simple quickly. That's what I consider to be my basic job. And this contrasts with academics, whose job is to make simple things complicated at great length. So, who would you rather hear from as a talk on a Tuesday night when you've been traveling all day? I'd pick a journalist. I don't care how intellectual you are. Sometimes it's nice to have some complicated things made simple. So, I've been spending the last 5 years of my life trying to make what Terry Eagleton calls the second most complicated word in the English language a little simpler, the word culture. I've read all the Germanic stuff. It's funny how a lot of sociology, even though it is allegedly written in English, still seems to be written in German. I've read long, paragraph-long definitions of culture that were enlightening. I've read Clifford Geertz and Peter Berger and Max Weber and Durkheim and all these people. I didn't retain any of it, but I did read them at one time. And no definition has been as helpful to me in getting my mind and heart around culture than one that I picked up in an interview with another journalist, who's quite an exceptional journalist named Ken Myers. Ken is the voice and heart behind the Mars Hill Audio Journal, which is a very, very helpful resource for thinking in a very unpredictably Christian way about the many features of the cultures that we live in. And he gave an interview to Regeneration, the magazine that I edited, and just tossed off the best definition of culture I've ever heard. And the best thing about it is none of the words are longer than one syllable, and the whole thing is about, I don't know, 7 or 8 words long. Ken said, culture is what human beings make of the world. And then he added the kicker that makes it really good. It's what human beings make of the world in both senses. And I have to say, he summed up for us what all the sociologists and anthropologists and all the other people whose job it is to make, well, what really is a very complicated thing, pretty complicated and abstract. He summed it up in an amazingly memorable and insightful way. Culture is what human beings make of the world in both senses. So the most natural meaning that comes to mind, I think, when we hear that phrase, is that culture is the stuff we make out of the world. It's the actual, tangible artifacts, as the anthropologists will say, of human beings taking the raw material of the created world they find around them and doing something with it. It can be quite rudimentary. Someone gives you a package of marshmallows and says, make a cultural artifact out of it, as we got to if you were paying close attention at the party this afternoon. And, you know, you make a little, I don't know, did anyone do anything with the marshmallows? Were there any marshmallow cultural artifacts? What did you make?
I made a representation of the Trinity.
A representation of the Trinity. Like I said, it can be very rudimentary, you know, quite basic, really. Not very ambitious. Well, I thought about making just a little, you know, tower of marshmallows or something. It can get quite complicated, quite intricate. And we can look around us and we could spend the rest of the night just cataloging the cultural artifacts that are present to our five senses right now. The lights in the ceiling, the acoustic tile in the ceiling, the chairs we're sitting on, the clothes we're wearing, all these things, the laptop I'm using, the PowerPointer that I'm pointing with, all things that somebody made out of the world. Wasn't originally there, but someone made this. Someone made these clothes. Someone made this room, this building, made something of the world, and that's culture. But Ken gets at the deeper reality of culture when he adds this little phrase, in both senses. Because when you hear something that's a little confusing or perplexing, you may say to your neighbor, what did you make of that? Right? What did you make of that? And we don't really mean, you know, what tangible good are you going to create? What tangible artifact are you going to make? We're asking, what sense does that have? So while culture is always the activity of making stuff, tangible, touchable, hearable, audible, smellable stuff, it is also always about making sense, making things and making meaning. Because the world that human beings find themselves in is not self-explaining. It doesn't explain itself at all. We did not ask to be born into it. We wake up, even in our adult lives, still perplexed by much of it. Sometimes the world is capable of inspiring in us the most extraordinary wonder, just the most extraordinary sense of beauty and awe. Where does that come from? No explanation is given by the world itself. And at other times, the world can fill us with the most extraordinary terror. And we're the ones who are lucky enough to have survived those experiences that have brought us right up to the edge of what we know awaits us, which is the loss of this wonderful, terrible life. And there's no explanation of that either. What sense does this world make? Well, the way human beings answer that question is culture. Culture is human beings trying to make sense out of a world that we didn't ask to be brought into, but find ourselves in, and just find ourselves yearning to make sense of. What I love about this definition, though, actually goes beyond just this kind of double meaning, stuff-making, sense-making. But the fact is that the way human beings make sense of the world is by making stuff. So the two meanings don't just happen to kind of go on parallel tracks, like some culture is the stuff we make and some is the sense. No, when human beings set out to make sense of the world, the way they do it, often unconsciously, often pre-theoretically, the way they make sense of the world, the only way we know how, is to make some more stuff. See, when you're an academic, you don't get to use the word stuff in a talk. But when you're a journalist, people don't respect you to begin with, so you can go right ahead. And to me, this is the really most extraordinary thing. That all, I would venture to say, all of the stuff making, all of the creation of the manifold cultural goods that accumulate over time in the human cultural project or projects is all bound up with this question of the sense of the world. The question of whether the world makes sense. Our attempt to venture a guess as to what kind of sense the world makes, and our attempt to kind of create some order and some sense in the midst of a chaotic and confusing world. Which means, of course, among other things, for Christians, this becomes intensely interesting because we believe the world does have meaning. We actually believe that the creator of the world has stepped into the world, stepped into the midst of this human stuff-making, sense-making project, and disclosed in the midst of that some clues to the ultimate meaning of this wonderful, terrible world. So we're interested in this. We're interested in it whenever it happens because it's ultimately religious. You can't pay attention to culture for long without being drawn into questions of ultimate meaning, because the world is ultimately challenging in its wonder and its terror. So here we are. We make cultural goods, and I thought I'd give an example or two just to make sure we're all on the same page. Some of you I know have heard me speak on this before, and you have heard of some of this material. I promise there will be fresh stuff tomorrow. But we have to all start at the same place, and a lot of you we're new to each other, and we have to sort of build some common vocabulary. So some of you remember this picture. This is not my baby. This is actually the number one result when you do a Google image search on the word baby. But every presentation needs a baby, so there he is. I guess he's wearing both pink and blue. That, you know, that's kind of ambiguous. Maybe it's a she. Who knows? Capable of many interpretations. Well, the best, most basic example of culture is what starts within moments of our birth. And it is this extraordinary thing called language. We arrive in the world. We all did this. It's hard to remember and believe it, isn't it? That we were all like this. But we all were, some of us more recently than others. And we came into the world with very limited capacities. This is one of the things that makes human beings human, right? How limited our capacities are when we are born. The most limited of all the animals at birth. The baby has no control over the baby's limbs. Really, the only thing the baby has to work with at first, before he, we'll say it's a he, finds his hands, you know, and then finds his feet, is this amazing thing called the human vocal tract. Lungs, larynx, tongue, resonating cavities in the head, lips, teeth. And so when the baby has had his three basic needs met, to be well-fed, to be well-slept, and to be well-cleaned and dry, the baby really doesn't have anything to do except lie in the crib, experimenting, making something of the world. Well, the only part of the world the baby has access to is the vocal tract, pretty much. So the baby lies there and experiments. Right? You know how this works. Like, this is not crying. I'm not talking about crying. That's when one of the three needs have not been met. But when they're all met, the baby has plenty of time on his hands. So, you know, tries out, first they don't probably have no idea what they're trying, but discovers, say, the, you know, labial stops. So, ba, 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 ba. Oh, we could do that unvoiced. Pa, 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 pa. That's interesting. Like, you turn off the voice a little early, you get a different sound. Oh, that's cool. So the baby's just kind of playing, experimenting, discovers dental stops. Okay? Unvoiced. Ta, 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 ta. Voiced. Da, 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 da. Well, one day the baby is practicing voiced dental stops. And a very important person in the baby's life comes into the room. And the baby says, "Dada, dada." And suddenly, this very important person displays an extraordinary degree of excitement. Leans over the crib and says, "He's saying daddy." Now, the baby was not saying daddy. I'm sorry, right? But this was a very interesting a piece of... a piece of his world just changed, right? Daddy went from being just sort of normal daddy to being really excited daddy. Picking him up, giving him a hug, you know, well, that was good. Suddenly the baby has access to a little more of the world. Well, the next time daddy walks in the room, maybe he tries again. Dad, 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 dad. Well, eventually he is saying dad. My son was actually saying doggy. But so we got rid of the dog, and then... then it meant daddy. Now, what has happened there, right? The baby's making something of the world, but suddenly, well, not suddenly, but over time, and really over an astonishingly short amount of time, the baby realizes, this makes sense. This makes sense of something important in my world, my relationship with my father, this person. I have a name for this person now. And the baby goes on to make sense of more of the world, mama, and whatever comes next, apple or ducky or, you know, gradually starts building sense out of sound. Making sense by making something. The world starts to come together. It starts to cohere. Because the baby's joining this long human project of making something of the world through language. So that's what culture is. You could think of a lot more examples, and we'll have a chance to talk about some in a minute. It's all these goods by which we make a piece of stuff that adds to the sense. It's always driven towards sense. Human beings are driven toward meaning. Culture is always yearning for meaning. That's what culture is. But what does culture do? One of the challenges, right, of being around academics a lot is they focus a lot on definitions and is the ontology of things. But one of the real valuable things, actually, about disciplines like sociology is the attention to function. Saying, okay, we can say what it is, but what does it do? What does culture do? If it's people making something of the world, okay, that's what it is, but what's the effect that it has in the world? And I'm not sure where I stumbled across this phrase, or maybe it might be the one thing I actually invented in the course of writing this book, because everything else I stole. But I was grasping for a way to talk about how thoroughly, as culture kind of accumulates, as people do this world-making project over successive generations, how thoroughly it shapes the world that we all live in. And the best phrase that I could come up with is that culture, over time, defines the horizons of the possible. As the human project of making something in the world accumulates over generations, because we don't start from scratch, right? We sort of pick up. Daddy is already a word. The baby sort of picks that up, joins this thing called the English language. As we join what other generations have done before us, we enter into a set of possibilities that have been carved out by previous kinds of making. I find buildings to be a very helpful example of this. What would happen if, instead of being invited to St. Mary's on the Lake, is that the name of our facility here? You were just told, you were just given a GPS coordinate, you know, minus 42 degrees, west and 36 degrees north, and we're just going to meet there and, you know, bring your gear because it's just wilderness, and we're going to have a meeting. Well, we'd spend a lot of Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday just keeping ourselves alive if we all just showed up at a predetermined point in the wilderness and tried to have a meeting. And I don't think we would have a PowerPoint either. But somebody built a building already. It's been here for a long time. We've been meeting here for years. It creates a space of possibility so that when we show up, we're free to do what we're doing now, to meet. We don't even have to cook our own food. Someone else is doing that. Culture has opened up for us a set of possibilities that wouldn't be available to us if someone hadn't already built this. So this building, why do people build buildings? It's to create spaces of possibility, to create horizons within which other kind of culture can happen. Because we're doing culture right now. At the moment, I'm doing most of the stuff making. I'm making sound waves, which you can translate into language. You're taking a few notes, maybe. We're all trying to make sense, more or less successfully, of what I have to present. But we're only free to do that. It's only available as a possibility because someone else built a lot of culture before us. Going back, in fact, all the way, at least, to the English language itself, which gives us the possibility of communicating with each other. Not all of us grew up speaking English, I'm guessing, in our homes. Maybe most of us, but not, I'm assuming not all in this room. But we all acquired that language, and suddenly fluent communication became possible. I can speak at my normal rate, you can understand it, you can react, you can ask me questions, only possible because of culture. Only possible because we all share that piece of culture called the English language, whether by birth or by acquisition. So as culture accumulates over time, it starts to widen the horizons of what human beings can do. And all of us in this room are really glad because there's no way you could be a graduate student, which most of us have been, without a lot of other people doing cultural work. I mean, if all of us had to show up in the wilderness every day, there would be no graduate students, right? It was only within the horizons of possibility of a culture that had valued learning for a long time, that's economically prosperous, that offered opportunities to us, that we had the possibility to study and learn and now to serve people who study and learn and teach. Strangely, though, at the same time as culture defines the horizons of possibility, opens up spaces of freedom and opportunity, it also defines the horizons of the impossible. Not just what we can do, but what we cannot do. Now, this is often harder, I think, for us to access. And this is partly because we live in a time of tremendously expanding possibility. Technology, the rise of technology in the last 100 years, within the lifetime of my grandparents, has opened up so many possibilities that were never available to human beings before. And technology is always sold on what you can do now that you couldn't do before, right? The way technology is always explained is, well, before you couldn't do this, but now you can. The horizon of the possible just got wider. The marketers and promoters of technology never talk about what you can no longer do once the technology is introduced into the culture. So one of the really amazing technological achievements of the 20th century was the interstate highway system. Something that, I mean, there have always been roadway systems, but the interstate highways took it to another level. Very intentionally, a huge project of creating a network of roads that would be uniform, divided lanes, you know, all the features of the interstates, opened up all sorts of possibilities for our culture. And if we had time, and one thing I love to do with groups, just spend a while talking about, like, what became possible because the interstate highways were built? What sense was made of the world, for better and for worse, because they were built? But at the same time as the highway system was opening up, you know, easy travel, easy commerce, makes it easier for books like mine to get to stores, you know, cheaply, and makes it easy for us to get to Mundelein. Mundelein is way closer to O'Hare, right, than it would have been for another generation, and that's a real possibility. But at the same time, other things that previously were completely possible become at least a lot more difficult. Finding non-fast food, right? Or, take a more extreme example, a few years ago, I read David McCullough's biography of John Adams. And in that book, John Adams travels back and forth about, I don't know, 24 times between Boston and Philadelphia by horse. And I got to thinking, would it be possible to travel today from Boston to Philadelphia by horse. This was completely possible in the 18th century. People did it very routinely, not a big deal. Could you do that today? I've decided you could only do it if it were for like a PBS reality special. You know, they'd have a film crew, it'd be this big deal. But could any of us just decide tomorrow we're going to ride from Boston to Philadelphia by horse? No, it's become impossible. At the same time as it's become totally possible to drive, or for that matter to fly, something else that was totally routine and normal for, you know, some of our ancestors, people just a few generations back, is now completely inaccessible. To do it now would be, you'd get arrested for cruelty to animals. They even have a little, you know, sign on some of the interstates with a little picture of a horse and a little line drawn through it, right? No longer possible. And I've become pretty convinced, though I can't prove this to you tonight, that every time a new cultural good is introduced, it both makes something possible that wasn't possible before and makes something else impossible or at least a lot more difficult than it was before. That's just what culture does. It moves the horizons of possibility and impossibility. So let me bring up a little complication that I think is really important for us in our cultural context. And then we're going to talk together about cultural goods that have made some things possible and impossible for us. One of the most common shorthands I hear among evangelical Christians when I tell them that I'm working on a book about culture is that they'll say something like, oh, I really believe Christians should engage the culture. I hear that frequently. Another verb I hear is, I really think we ought to be impacting the culture. And I don't exactly disagree, I think, with the sentiments behind those statements. Or people will say, oh, I really care about transforming the culture. There's just one problem. There's no such thing as the culture. Because what is culture? It's human beings making stuff, trying to make sense, and it's handed on from generation to generation. But not everybody has the same stuff. And so not everybody makes the same sense of the world. See, if there were a thing we could call the culture, it would be one shared set of cultural goods that everybody grew up with, that were the language we spoke in our home, the kind of food we ate, the kind of buildings we lived in, the kind of education we got. And it would all sort of seamlessly make sense because everyone would share the exact same set of cultural goods. But in fact, you and I, no matter how similar we might even seem to one another, grew up with a slightly different set of things that people had made of the world in our world. So some of us, the vast majority of us, I sense, were born in the U.S., so we share a lot of things that were sort of public goods within the culture of the United States. But within the culture of the United States, there are many different ethnic traditions within which people make very different stuff. Think about dinner, for example. Well, first of all, in my father's family, coming from the Midwest, you didn't actually call it dinner. That was noon on Sunday, all right? It was called supper, all right? Supper was the evening meal. How many of you grew up calling it supper? Oh, wow, a lot. This is a very Midwestern group. How many of you grew up calling it dinner? There we go. Interesting. And if we, like, made a little map of the U.S. and then we all sort of walked to our place and looked at where the hands, we'd see, oh, we made different things in the world right there. We had different language. Well, that's fairly superficial. We all know what we're talking about, dinner, supper. But what did you eat? Your family ate something a little different from my family. And your cultural tradition knew how to cook things different from your neighbor's cultural tradition. And if it's true that culture is always not just about making stuff, but also about making sense, then your neighbor at your table made slightly different sense of the world. So there's no such thing as the culture. There are many cultural traditions of making something of the world, each with its own horizons of the possible and the impossible. There's a great moment of cultural collision in the film Avalon. Are they Russian? I can't remember. There's an immigrant family that's moved to Baltimore. And one of the key values of their immigrant tradition is that when they have family dinners, they wait until the last family member has arrived before they start the dinner. Because you just can't have dinner without the whole family, and we don't mean nuclear family, right? The whole extended family has to be there. And there's one member of the extended family and his wife who always show up late. And everyone gets mad, but everyone always waits, right? Well, the whole film is really about assimilation to American culture. In American culture, do we wait until the whole extended family is there before we start eating? I mean, we hardly eat dinner together at all anymore in white American culture. So this family is assimilating to dominant American culture, and the crucial turning point in the movie is when that extended family member shows up late and they've already started. See, for some of us, and for many more folks who aren't in this room, dinner always meant the whole family. And not just mom and dad and the 2.5 kids, but aunties and uncles and cousins and that person who we're not exactly sure how he's related, but he's just always been treated as part of the family. That was Sunday dinner every week. And for others of us, getting our extended family together at Thanksgiving is probably not really possible. Distant possibility. Happens once in a while. Making slightly different sense of the world. Different horizons of what's possible and impossible. In some families, getting down to the family level, it's impossible to love one another and argue with one another. In other families, it's impossible to love one another and not argue with one another. And when two people from those two different cultures marry, it gets really interesting. In my Southern culture, you're nice to my mom's Southern culture, which formed my family culture, you're nice to strangers and mean to your family. In my wife's Northeastern WASP culture, you're nice to your family and mean to strangers. What happens when you put those two together? Don't ask. So what happens when we encounter another culture? We encounter different horizons of possibility and impossibility. And that is very uncomfortable. Because this is why you have to get to the function of culture, to define the horizons of the possible and the impossible. When you just put it at the level of, well, you know, culture is what we make of the world, and your culture makes one thing and my culture makes another, that doesn't sound so, why would that be a problem? But when your culture has defined for you a set of horizons of what is thinkable and unthinkable, sayable and unsayable, doable and undoable, and you encounter another set of human beings for whom the things that for you are unthinkable are thinkable, and the things that for you are unsayable are sayable. That is very uncomfortable. It's really difficult. It's tiring. It's challenging. Well, I have like 20 more things to say about that. They're all in my notes, but I'm not going to say them right now because I want to get you talking to one another. Let's think about this. Let's just zero in on two. What were two cultural goods, very specific things, that in some significant way for you shaped your horizons of what was possible and impossible? Let's pick one from your childhood, your upbringing, and one from your years as a student. College, university student, or whenever in your student career you want to pick. And let me just give an example from my own life to get you thinking. The first thing that came to mind when I thought about this question yesterday for myself was I remembered my family's home, which was on 7 acres in a rural part of New York State outside of Syracuse, New York. And in the backyard, the back, like, 5 acres, we had made something of the world. We had mown paths kind of through the, it wasn't exactly woods, but kind of scrubby, brushy, woody area. But there were these grass paths that just kind of went in this nice pattern. Someone had done that before we moved in. We kept them. We kept mowing them. I mowed them every week once I was old enough. And those paths made something of my world as a 9-year-old, as a 10-year-old. It was a place that I could wander and be alone and yet be safe. And I would hear the world around me. I'd see and smell it, smell the cornfields on three sides. What did that make possible for me? What did that make impossible or less likely, less, more difficult? Another really different example from my student years. I walked into the library, Boston University School of Theology, not really knowing what I was looking for, but looking on a certain section of shelf for a term paper that I was writing. And I found a book. It was a book by a newly minted PhD named Richard Hayes, the New Testament. It was called The Faith of Jesus Christ. I pulled it off the shelf. I didn't know what I was getting. It wasn't assigned. Just happened to be sitting there in a library. And I read this book, and he explained to me what I'd been seeing in the Gospel of Mark and in my studies of the Bible with InterVarsity students at Harvard. He gave me words for what I had intuited about the unity of the New Testament. He gave me a new way of looking at Scripture, a cultural good. He'd made something, an actual thing, a book. And the book made sense of something that I couldn't have named otherwise. So what cultural goods did that for you? Why don't you turn to your partner that we picked out and see if you can name those two, and then just give each other a little sketch of what it made possible or impossible for you. Well, one of the good things about doing this exercise early on is it gives us something to talk about for the whole rest of the week. When you're with someone and there's that awkward silence, you can say, so what was one of your cultural goods? Now, I assume, partly because of the way I set up the question, that the things that we shared with one another largely made things possible for us that we're grateful for, right? That open up, at least all the examples that were just mentioned, certainly opened up good new horizons. And that's true of a lot of culture. At the same time, if we took the time and developed the trust with one another, we could talk about cultural goods from our families, from our cultural tradition, from our nation, that move the horizons in really unhelpful ways. I'm not sure that the horizons of possibility for a dating teenager when I was in high school were the best for my own development as a now as a husband, let's say, and a faithful man. I'm not sure that the way I was taught to think about my own skin color, completely tacitly, never any overt mention of what the horizons ought to be, but I'm not sure that those horizons, as I've grown, I've realized those horizons were misplaced, seriously misplaced. There were things that were possible for me to think and imagine that never should have been possible, and other things that were impossible for me to think or imagine about other human beings that should have been completely possible. But it just wasn't in the horizons of my culture. No one tried to tell me. It just was what I could see, what I could imagine. And when we probe each tradition of making something of the world, whether it's the tradition of a nation, the tradition of an ethnic group over time, the tradition of a particular family, and we hold them up against God's disclosure of the sense of the world, we realize the horizons are always wrong. There's something that's possible that God never intended to be possible. There are a lot of things in our culture and in every culture. And there are things in my culture, in your culture, in the culture of this town, in the culture of this county, in the culture of the immigrant families in this county, and the culture of the long-established families in this county. There are things that God never intended to be impossible, but that just seem impossible. What do we do with that? What do we do with that mismatch of horizons? That's what we'll talk about tomorrow. So thank you all very much for your attention tonight, and I look forward to picking it up again with you tomorrow morning.